Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, North Mecklenburg State Senator Vicki Sawyer says there's still a lot of work ahead to make the regional transit plan palatable to lawmakers. Perhaps there is a plan B after all, should those lawmakers nix a referendum this fall. At least according to Vi Lyles, we'll fill you in. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announces Fort Liberty will be called Fort Bragg once again, but there's a difference this time, and the push to bring the WNBA back to Charlotte gets a boost of support from the Hornets. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE senior editor Eli Portillo. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Good morning, everybody. Welcome.
Good morning.
So this is the year that Charlotte and the Metropolitan Transit Commission hopes to have legislative approval to put a 1 cent sales tax referendum for transit on the November ballot. And this week, Republican State Senator from North Mecklenburg, Vicki Sawyer, who is leading that bill through the General Assembly, says chances for passage look iffy. Mary, why?
Yes, so this is not necessarily a new message from Senator Sawyer. She has repeatedly said that while she is personally supportive of the idea, especially the red line, given where her district is located in North Mecklenburg, that being said, a tax increase, as she has said multiple times, is going to be hard to swallow for the Republican caucus. And it appears, based on her latest messages, that that continues to be a hurdle as she tries and gets this bill some consideration in the state Senate.
I mean, we've already adjusted our original plan to comport more closely to the feelings of the legislative leaders in the General Assembly. And it's now we have four different plans, all of which have a 40% split, 40% for rail, 40% for roads, 20% for buses. Are there other adjustments that they would like in Raleigh, or is this simply about reluctance to raise taxes?
Honestly, I don't think we know at this point. I mean, beyond what Vicki Sawyer is saying about the just philosophical difference between a Democratic council and a Republican-led General Assembly, and their dislike for any sort of tax, no matter what form it takes, it's still not clear to a lot of us what the issue might be and why there's not better communication. I used this before we came on air. If you are applying for a federal grant and you're a city entity, you are going to make sure that you fall within all the parameters of that federal grant. For whatever reason, maybe it's political philosophies being different, there doesn't seem to be a clear connect between what the General Assembly wants and what the city's willing to do.
Eli.
Yeah, I just think, you know, there's not any appetite in Raleigh with Republicans in the majority to give a Democratic-led city a tax increase for a transit plan. I mean, that's like a vegan restaurant approving, you know, putting new steak on the menu. It's just philosophically diametrically opposed. And I think, you know, it might sneak in as a random thing added to some bill that passes in June. Who knows? That always seems to happen in Raleigh. But there's not an appetite for the Republican-led General Assembly to champion Charlotte's urban tax increase-fueled transit plan. And that's a reality that I think the city has to accept at this point.
Ryan.
Yeah, and I saw Vicki Sawyer's quote about that same thing Eli just said in terms of Republicans. You know, you can't convince them that they want to raise taxes on Mecklenburg County, especially in a place that they don't, if they're, those aren't their constituents. But I think it's just important to mention that that's not what they're doing, because all they're doing is giving our constituents permission to vote on said thing. And that will be a huge struggle on its own. But no one in the state legislature is being asked to do anything other than let our residents vote on the tax.
Perhaps you haven't seen the new NBC sitcom, Raleigh Knows Best. Perhaps you haven't watched that. It's 8 o'clock, must-see TV. City Councilwoman Dimple Ashmera commented also on Vicki Sawyer's phrase, it's a long way from being palatable, earlier this week. Here's what she had to say.
Senator Vicki Sawyer had said that she is facing some skepticism And there are some roadblocks and challenges, especially with Republicans in the majority in Raleigh, where they are not in favor of raising taxes, especially after expanding our food and beverage tax.
She made that comment on this program earlier this week in a conversation we had with four chairs of various city council committees. We've been dancing around this for years. We've made changes to placate legislative leaders. It still sounds like an uphill battle. And City Council Republican Ed Driggs on this program on Wednesday also highlighted the fact that the plan could be an economic force at a time when the General Assembly is looking for economic drivers.
I think it's to be expected that it's going to be difficult. I'm still hopeful that the leadership have acknowledged in my conversations with them that Mecklenburg is a great driver of growth in North Carolina, and choking on mobility is not good for us or for the state.
Senator Sawyer told Axios Charlotte, quote, "It's not a popular thing to ask conservatives for the right to raise taxes for a county they don't represent." Well, isn't that the point of having a city council? I mean to tell you, they also don't live here. Can we assume that they understand the economic development possibilities that Ed Drake spoke about a moment ago?
They're really trying to get them to understand that. As Ryan just pointed out, the bill in the legislature would not raise taxes. It would simply give Mecklenburg County voters the opportunity to decide. That is something the city has tried to put at the forefront of their messaging. They've tried to focus on the roads money. They have tried to focus on the economic development aspect, and they have tried to get Republican voices like Vicki Sawyer and Tricia Cotham to take point in Raleigh. They've tried to really rally the business community around that. And despite all of those efforts, it just feels like we're still failing to get that traction with the legislators that we need to get this through. So I think that's really the crux of the issue for Charlotte, is that on paper, you look at that messaging, it doesn't necessarily seem like the wrong play, but it just doesn't seem to be effective thus far.
I know that Eli wants to get in on this, but it's not just Charlotte. This is a regional effort, and a lot of this money is going to go for roads, and that money will go and be spent and decided upon how it will be spent by the towns in Mecklenburg County. Do they not have a dog in this race? Are they in on these conversations with Raleigh? Do they not say, hey, we would like this money because we need this road, we need that road, whatever?
Sure, it's still all Mecklenburg, though. I mean, you know, they're talking about a Mecklenburg County sales tax, so it would still only be money spent here. In even when you count the Republican-leaning towns, it's still a majority Democratic blue site. And, you know, I think right now it's kind of like Schrodinger's transit plan. It's all things to all people, and nobody knows quite what's inside it because nobody's actually done it yet. But I mean, the city does have alternatives. This whole discussion has been framed for years around, we have to get this from Raleigh. Mecklenburg County has the authority right now to put a quarter cent sales tax on the ballot. They tried this with the art sales tax back in 2019, I think, and it failed to pass. But that is still authority that the county has. Charlotte can also raise property taxes on its own without legislative approval. So the city, they could decide right now, we're going to raise property taxes, and we're going to put a quarter cent sales tax on the ballot, and we're going to pay for as much of this transit plan we want as ourselves. But that's not really being talked about. They keep going back to Raleigh, understandably, to get the big plan passed, but there are alternatives. I don't quite know why they haven't penetrated the public discussion yet, but I think that framing is important to acknowledge.
When you start bringing Schrodinger and Schrodinger's cat into this physics conversation that we're having, you're getting pretty deep. Next, it's going to be Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg. We've already committed to buying the Norfolk Southern tracks on which the Red Line train will run. But in December, City Councilman Malcolm Graham pointed out that we have put all of our eggs in one basket. And he said that back then that there was no plan B should the referendum not be approved. But then he added this.
I'm cautiously optimistic, but boy, there's a lot of work that has to be done in a short period of time to accomplish it.
So what has to be done? I mean, we have to finalize the plan. That's one of the things that has to be done, because there are four of them right now. But what else has to be done?
In addition to just the procedural aspect of things, the legislature approving this, the county commission doing all the procedural steps it has to get things on the ballot, there's also the matter of marketing this plan to the voters. That's something that is really a focus. Councilman Driggs on this program earlier this week said he's already starting to get concerned that they're not going to have enough time to put together an organized campaign to really get the voters to back this. Because even if by some miracle things do get through the legislature and it's on that ballot the first Tuesday in November, it all means nothing if at least 51% of the voters in Mecklenburg County don't sign off.
So, Ben, Malcolm Graham has spoken about the city having no plan B should the legislature fail to allow this referendum on the ballot, or if the voters say no to that referendum. But you spoke this week with Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles and asked her directly what would happen if the legislature fails to act. She had a slightly different take.
If a referendum doesn't make it to the ballot this year, what happens? Is there a backup plan?
Next year is a backup plan. So if we can't do it this year, but we get the permission, we will put it on the ballot for our voters to decide if this is something that they believe that will have a good economic impact, that we will have better safety, and we will have better roads and buses.
Okay, so I listened to that clip at least 10 times. That's absolutely true, and I have no idea what she said. So what is she saying?
I think, and she might be speaking out of turn with some other members of council and things like that, but I think she's expressing an optimism beyond this November that some others might not have. Also, I focus in on that statement when she says get permission. So I think it could very well be that she's saying if we got the permission as a city from the General Assembly to move forward, then if it didn't get on the actual referendum ballot in November, then we could try it again, because under that scenario, we would have the blessing of the General Assembly. Again, it's a level of optimism I'm not sure too many other city leaders have right now.
And she also told you, Ben, that although she can't speak for Republican lawmakers, she believes that with the changes we've made to the plan at their request, we have put forth an effort that shows them the opportunity that the plan provides. She said, quote, "Charlotte is a region now. When we go by ourselves to Raleigh, we don't get things done. When we go with the region, I think there's real potential for our legislators to understand that this is something that we have to do together." If you go as a region, do you have to have 100% buy-in on this plan? And I ask because Matthews is not in on this. They don't want any part of this because of the Silver Line. Ryan.
Yep.
Ben, Ryan, who cares? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the city council will tell you that there's not necessarily 100% buy-in, but as you all discussed on this program Wednesday, Matthews is now hired a lobbyist at a convenient time for them, inconvenient time for City of Charlotte. That's going to be up in Raleigh discussing their distaste with how this plan has worked out. So that's going to be a major factor in how lawmakers up there look at it.
He's not just lobbying against the transit plan. He's up there to convince them of other things that Matthews needs. But just the idea that they have hired somebody to go there and point out the negatives to Matthews of this transit plan, what message is that sending to legislators who are already on the fence?
They'll pounce. They're looking for a reason, and in many cases, not to be on board with this. So they can quickly point to Matthews and say, listen, you all can't even get on the same page with this. How are we possibly going to approve a new tax for you all, or at least a new tax for the voters to vote on in November? They'll pounce.
But we can't get on the same page because of the parameters they set to pass this referendum. They did this. They made this happen. The Silver Line was in the original plan. So isn't Raleigh to blame?
My head hurts.
I know. Okay. Well, we're just getting started.
I know it's pie in the sky, but I still go back to what I said. I don't understand why you can't get the stakeholders at the state level in the same room as the city and not let them leave a room until they talk.
Break out the Excedrin and the Advil, because if you think your head hurts now, we're just getting started. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. That's why Eli Portillo is with us. He's senior editor for WFAE News. Ryan Pitkin is founder and editor at Queen City Nerve. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. More on the city council moving to the budget. The council is taking their preliminary looks at that. Last month, city staff told council they didn't plan to raise property taxes, though Mecklenburg County is seriously considering doing so. But at last January's meeting, City Manager Marcus Jones cautioned that rising costs related to growth will likely mean future tax increases. This is a city council election year, one that might have a 1 cent sales tax referendum for transit on the ballot. Are we likely to hold the line on raising property taxes, Eli, in that environment?
Yeah, so far, that's what it seems like staff is indicating, that they don't have to this year, but, some raise this year. Some council members have questioned, are we kicking the can down the road? And the rising costs are really for the same factors that we're seeing impact businesses everywhere. The city's paying more in benefits. They're paying more in salaries. They have seriously, and I think most people would say deservedly, raised first responder salaries a lot for police and fire, which is by far the biggest share of the city's budget, even though we don't talk about them that much comparatively. So I think it's inevitable. The city staff really likes to display a chart of all the major cities in Charlotte and their relative property taxes, and they love to point out that Charlotte is at the bottom. And Charlotte has the lowest property taxes of a major North Carolina city. So they love to point that out. And there's a lot of room between Charlotte and the next lowest for them to raise and still be the lowest in North Carolina.
At Monday's council meeting, Republican Councilman Ed Driggs was one of those people pondering the effects of kicking the can down the road, as you called it. He says that it's important not to have a tax increase, but he's worried.
During this budget process, if we have some kind of alchemy that says that we can do it without a tax increase, count me in, yes. But the question is how? And are we eroding any kind of fundamental services of the city in order not to have a tax increase?
So he mentioned eroding services. So when Ed Driggs was on this program on Wednesday, I asked him if we are eroding services while avoiding what will eventually have to happen so that voters might be more inclined to say yes to a transit tax in November.
So, Mike, I said last year that I thought we were setting the table for future tax increases. I have a concern about sending a message out to the public that we can accomplish all of these things and that there is no pain involved. And I should also explain, when we did the revaluation of the property, and then we reset the tax rate, which is a normal procedure after a revaluation, we did a revenue neutral reset. But that didn't take into account inflation. And so we are actually seeing our real property tax proceeds decline. So I do believe that we're getting ourselves into a position where we're going to have to make tough choices in the future.
So Charlotte City Council on Monday also, Ryan, took up a number of other things, including listening to a presentation about violence as a public health crisis. They also gave them an overview of the county's violence prevention plan, Atrium Health Hospital-based violence intervention program, and the city of Charlotte's alternatives to violence program. The county's plan has been in place since 2022, and yet crime is rising. And Malcolm Graham said, despite our best efforts, in the eyes of the public, we are still falling short. Presenters at council also elicited comments from council members of the consequences of different approaches, including a suggestion from Republican Tariq Bakari to start a Charlotte's Most Wanted list. How would that work, Ryan?
Right. So from what he and he was sort of throwing out an idea, it sounded like, but the way he described it was not like televising a list and then VCAT goes and grabs these people. It's more of a thing that he was proposing, in an idea that there are certain folks who are such repeat offenders that if they are picked up again for something, then they are, red flags go off everywhere and they're not let back out on the streets to continue to rack up dozens of charges, I think was the way that he described it.
Did he?
It was apparently a similar thing that Pat McCrory did when he, where that was run under Pat McCrory's mayorship.
Council also voted to approve the structure of a new 17-member Arts, Science, and Culture Council, or ASCC, to distribute funds related to the arts. Is this separate from, or in conjunction with, or just the name for joining forces with Foundation for the Carolinas and the Arts and Science Council and their newly constituted efforts?
It is the same plan. So this is an idea that was proposed a while ago now. The Foundation for the Carolinas and the organization formerly known as the ASC have already formalized their partnership. Mecklenburg County began a few months ago appointing their members to this new board. But the city of Charlotte had continued to pretty much just sit on the plan. It was approved by the Economic Development Committee back in September, I believe, but there had been continued questions from some council members about a few different issues, how much oversight the city was going to have over this new, over all of this investment, whether or not the board structure was fair and equitable, whether or not the city was going to be paying too much in administrative fees to the foundation as part of this new agreement. A lot of those questions came back up ahead of Monday's vote. There was a lot of discussion. It seemed briefly like this might not get through, but ultimately some people came around and it passed 8-2.
It passed 8-2, as you were going to say. The city withdrew from funding the ASC a couple of years ago and started their own arts funding mechanism, which didn't last very long, and now they've decided to join this new one. And council member Victoria Watlington was one of the two no votes on council, because she said this, quote, feels like reinvesting in the same approach we were taking before, except now we have less opportunity to have a direct decision-making space. Is she right?
I don't think so, because this, the difference here is that I think the city wanted more, or elected officials wanted more say, and what they had created under the Arts and Culture Office had been sort of a large board of local creatives who then just sort of sent put grants ideas together, grant allocations together, and then send it to council for a quick approval, probably part of the consent agenda. But this would be a board that is actually made up of elected officials from Mecklenburg County, City of Charlotte, town surrounding. And that's sort of the change here, as opposed to just sort of a board that I think some people had some worries was not being held accountable and was maybe a lot of friends of different artists who were helping out their friends.
Well,
which is not necessarily I'm saying was necessarily the truth, but I think that was a concern.
There's no real good way to do this, to be honest with everybody. But as was pointed out by Councilwoman Dimple Ashmira, the $2 million reserved for individual artists and independent arts organizations approved in last year's budget still has not been allocated. Why not?
So this is a separate pool of money. So there was the infusion fund for 3 years. That's gone. That was the city's sort of stopgap arts funding option while they were figuring out what they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And then last year, we had this new plan rolled out by the Foundation for the Carolinas and the ASC. The city had not yet decided whether to participate. So in last year's budget, they said, we're going to allocate just some one-time money. Originally, that money was going to be they were going to enlist Charlotte is Creative to help distribute those grants. During the debates over the new Foundation for the Carolinas plan, it also came up within council that some council members were concerned about how that was going to work. So they decided to go with a different process called Request for Proposals, which is what's used for a lot of other different situations where the city is contracting out. So City Manager Marcus Jones explained Monday that the reason for the delay is that change in process means they sort of had to go back to square one in terms of figuring out who this money is going to. So they're in the process of taking applications from people and deciding how to spend that $2 million in individual arts grants.
Before we move on, can you pass me that bottle of Excedrin, please? Thank you. meanwhile, speaking of money, city council elections and the election for mayor are but 7 months away. Several city council members, however, are more than a year late in filing campaign finance reports that they are required to do by state law. Is that for the upcoming election, Eli, or the previous election?
Well, it's the regular reports that they file, on a quarterly, on an ongoing basis when they're active. So they say, I have a campaign committee. I'm going to be running again. This last quarter, I raised this much money from these people. And it's very common for them to be late. It's kind of a spring ritual in the journalism world to go look them up and see who's late, because there's really not a strong consequence for being late.
Well, I was going to ask about that and about who's policing this, because James Mitchell is among those council members. And according to WFAE Steve Harrison, he hasn't filed since the last Democratic primary in 2023. And you say this is supposed to be quarterly. He's also frequently missed those deadlines. Mayor Pro Tem Dante Anderson also hasn't filed since November 2023. The same is true of Tywana Brown, September 2023. So this is not unusual.
Oh, well, it's not. And unfortunately, I think that goes to the question you were asking of who's policing this. It's the kind of thing where it should, I think, for the public's interest, be something that's considered a basic of transparency. But a lot of times when we contact these folks, they kind of say some version of, oops, my bad, I'll upload those and go upload them to the state. You have to be very, very, very egregiously non-compliant to, you know, get fined or get a serious consequence. It's almost always an, oops, I should have done that, or my treasurer should have done that. Hey, we'll get on it. And I guess it's part of the public service we provide of reminding the elected officials to do that and then hoping they do.
Charlotte Catholic High School principal Laurie Phillips will be stepping down today. There's been a flurry of controversies in recent weeks, including a decision to switch to a Catholic-centric accreditation system called Lumen. That prompted some pushback this week, Ben, from, well, the last couple of weeks, actually, from parents. Why?
Well, it's sort of been a perfect storm of that. The accreditation change, there have been staff departures, and then what is often so often the case in situations like that, there's video this week now, and that's what made the rounds on TV stations, and that was Phillips meeting with parents, talking about some of their concerns, and at one point in that video that was leaked, a parent says, asked about the culture problem there at Charlotte Catholic, and the principal responds, the culture problem starts right here, and gestures towards the people and parents in the audience, and there's a audible gasp from those people at that point.
Well, let me. We have that audio. It's a little difficult to hear because it was recorded on a phone, and there's a lot of room noise. And we doctored the audio in terms of making it clearer to hear. We didn't edit anything. We just used equalization to make it clearer. But it's still hard to hear. But I should note that when Laurie Phillips talks about we have a culture problem here, meaning in the room, she does so with a smile on her face. I don't think she meant it vindictively, but take a close listen to this.
I agree with you. There is a culture problem.
Right, and that needs to be addressed like today.
There's a culture problem right here.
What?
Okay, so she was being asked by a parent. I'm going to play it again in a second, but she was being asked by a parent. The parent made a point of saying that she had said that the teachers there were loved and appreciated, but that the teachers didn't feel that way. Then she agrees with the parent, but then she says there's a culture problem here, meaning in the room. Play it again.
I agree with you. There is a culture problem.
Right, and that needs to be addressed like today.
There's a culture problem right here.
What?
So you heard the reaction in the room. Was that the nail in the coffin?
I think you're being generous in your interpretation, and some people might agree, but clearly the parents in that room, that did not go over well. And I think that could have very well been the nail in the coffin of what's been a difficult few weeks there for staff as well as parents and students.
So the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte Superintendent Gregory Monroe has stood by this decision to use Lumen as the accreditation system. He argues that it meets the same standards as any other accrediting body and that all of the diocese schools have made the switch. Given what just happened with parents feeling disrespected, is that likely to change?
Honestly, I wouldn't be the person to tell you that. I'm not sure if that's going to change or not. I think probably the situation and the waters there around Charlotte Catholic need to calm for a little bit before anybody is going to be making a wholesale change like that.
So, Camp Bragg was established in 1918. It later became Fort Bragg until the name was changed in 2023 by the Biden administration to Fort Liberty. Well, everything old is new again.
I direct the Army to change the name of Fort Liberty, North Carolina, to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. That's right. Bragg is back.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, but not so fast. This is a different Bragg. So, Eli, take us through this. The original Bragg was Braxton Bragg, a Confederate general, correct?
Yep. Confederate general, major slaveholder, and according to the history I've read, actually a very poor general as well, lost all his battles. this Bragg is Roland Bragg, who was a private who fought in World War II, and he won a Silver Star and was wounded under fire. Apparently, he just got a Wikipedia page, so he's not like some super well-known dude, but he fought in the Battle of the Bulge, stole an German ambulance, drove wounded Americans to safety, was wounded himself, briefly captured by the Germans. So Roland Bragg, the new Bragg, seems like a great guy, at least based on that. I should note, there have been around 150,000 Silver Stars awarded during the course of U.S. history. So while Roland Bragg certainly sounds like an honorable soldier, it's not like he was chosen for anything besides his name. There are 150,000 other Silver Star recipients.
That was going to be my question, Ben.
Yeah, so often the case in a big, you know, ceremoniously large announcement like this, families notified, they give a heads up. They found out from a TV reporter. That's how they found out. The mayor of Fayetteville found out also from TV reporters. The people that you'd think be impacted by this were blindsided by the news that this was even happening, although we're very excited. I mean, we should say Mr. Bragg died 25 years ago.
And there's also no relation between these two Braggs. Roland Bragg is not related in any way to Braxton Bragg.
No, and Roland Bragg, I thought is kind of funny. I believe he's from Massachusetts, I think. Hmm. So, you know, in theory, on the opposite side, which, I mean, hey, in the base renaming stuff, the Trump administration, they could have just said, we're renaming this after Braxton Bragg. So, you know, they didn't do that. I think in some ways it might be too clever by half. You got to imagine they're looking to find other Picketts or Lees out there who served in the Army as well. Who knows?
Cosmetics and marketing. That's what it's all about. When we come back, your head's going to explode because we're going to talk about the Riggs-Griffin case, which continues in the courts. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE at WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Eli Portillo is with us. He's senior editor for WFAE News. Ryan Pitkin is founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Ben Thompson, an anchor at WCNC-TV. As we have been discussing since the November election, the contest for a seat on the state Supreme Court is still unresolved, although Democratic incumbent Allison Riggs has kind of won. She's ahead by 734 votes after several bipartisan recounts. She's still being challenged by Republican Judge Jefferson Griffin. And last week, a federal court on Friday, the U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, decided that the most appropriate avenue for this dispute was the North Carolina State Court. So back it went, and that's where it sits now. But Justice Allison Riggs sat on the bench at the High Court this Tuesday to hear cases. Her term ended, I guess, in December. The election that she won has yet to be certified. It won't be certified until all of this ends. Why is she hearing oral arguments? Ryan.
Possession is 9/10 of the law, and she possesses the seat, I suppose. But, you know, they have moved to try to move this forward faster this week in terms of the State Board of Elections asking for to skip over the Court of Appeals and just send it straight to the NC Supreme Court. So I feel like that's sort of the most interesting aspect of this week's update to this ongoing saga.
I'm going to get to that. In a statement, Riggs said, I remain committed to speaking up on behalf of the voters that Jefferson Griffin is seeking to disenfranchise. As a constitutional officer, I swore an oath to defend our state and federal constitutions and the rule of law. I will continue to uphold my duty, including holding accountable any elected officials who thwarts the will of the voters. Wing. Sounds like a slap in the face to Jefferson Griffin, her opponent. That's what it is, right?
Right. And she knows he won't respond. I'm starting to feel like he feels like he lost this a long time ago, but the GOP spent all of the last 2 years putting together this plan to challenge any close election. And this is the one that they jumped on.
So this is back in the state courts. Last Friday, the Wake County Superior Court heard arguments and rejected all of Jefferson Griffin's election protests, which involved disqualifying upwards of 66,000 ballots. So the logical path now for it is to go through the State Court of Appeals. It probably won't because of what you just talked about, Ryan, which we'll talk about in a second. But Jefferson Griffin sits on the State Court of Appeals. Would he be assigned to that case? Would he recuse himself from that case? Would he have to recuse himself from that case? Because I know that the Democratic Party has said that he and two other Republican judges should be recused should that go to that court.
Right, yeah, and it's almost certain that he will not be selected. There will be an uproar if he is. I wouldn't put anything past him as far as recusing himself or not recusing himself, but there's another judge there in charge of choosing three judge panel out of 12. And I just would never see it happening that they would select Jefferson Griffin to rule on his own case.
So yesterday, the North Carolina Election Board announced it will ask the state Supreme Court, as you said, to weigh in on this, bypass the Court of Appeals so that a resolution to this might come a little more quickly. Allison Riggs is on board with that. Is it likely to happen? And if so, how quickly might it find its way to the state Supreme Court?
I'm not sure about the quickness of it, but the reason they're asking for this is very interesting in the sense that, you know, the statement they put out, the State Board of Elections, is that we're all in charge. We all need to get this thing wrapped up. And yes, that's 100% true. But there's also a political meaning behind it in the sense that if they do skip over the Court of Appeals, then they will need a majority from the NC Supreme Court. Whereas if they do not skip over and it gets sent to the NC Supreme Court anyway, as it's likely to do, then they'll just need a split.
This is how Brian Anderson described this. Brian Anderson has reported extensively on this in his publication, Anderson Alerts. If the Supreme Court agrees to bypass the Court of Appeals, Jefferson Griffin would need a 4-2 ruling from the court in his favor to nullify the lower court's ruling last week rejecting all of his protests, which involved the disqualification of 66,000 ballots. However, if the high court allows the case to go to the Court of Appeals first, then they rule in his favor, he would just need a 3-3 split from the state Supreme Court when that decision is appealed. Am I getting this right?
Right, yeah.
Why the difference in numbers? It's the same court.
Well, if there is a Court of Appeals ruling and the Supreme Court deadlocks on that, then the lower court ruling stands. Mm-hmm. So that's why.
And
there's nothing to stand if they skip over it.
So we talked about if it goes to the Court of Appeals, Judge Griffin being on the court and the likelihood of his recusing himself from that case or not being assigned to it in the first place. But at the moment, Allison Riggs is sitting on the Supreme Court. Would she have to recuse herself?
Yeah.
She would. And she's already committed to doing that over this long 100 days.
But has Jefferson Griffin committed to recusing himself should it go to the Court of Appeals?
He's been silent. No one's hearing anything from him.
Okay. Well, this could go on for months, and even if it goes to the state Supreme Court, could be appealed to the United States Supreme Court. So we're not done with this yet. Last year, CMS set a new goal to increase the number of students graduating on track to enroll in higher education, enlist in the military, or be employed. And now they have some numbers to see how they're doing toward that goal. Eli, what does it show?
Yeah, so basically these measures are hitting certain benchmarks in terms of test scores or, you know, other measures of career readiness, and they call them the three E's. Their goal this year was 74% of graduating students meeting that. One of those benchmarks, they actually exceeded that, and 76% of graduating students met one of those benchmarks. Their goal is to get to 85% in 4 years. So, you know, they're inching up on track to reach that. They still have some challenges, though, that the superintendent pointed out.
Maybe I was fortunate to go to a really great high school, and I think I was. It was a public high school. But 85%.
Were you from Montgomery County, Maryland?
No, Alexandria, Virginia.
I was
T.C.
Moco.
T.C. Williams. You went to Montgomery County. Anyway, their goal was 85% by 2029. How does that stack up with other schools around the country? How does that stack up with the preparedness for jobs, military, or higher education in the 1970s, the 60s, the 80s? Pick a decade.
You know, I don't know that they're directly comparable. First, two reasons. One, this is kind of a CMS created measure. So, you know, this is how they're judging themselves. But as far as I know, it's not like a standard that you could compare all districts like some others out there. The other thing is, it's a lot more complex than graduating high school in the 70s right now, I think. For example, you know, just being familiar with computers. CMS is doing a survey on using AI in the classroom right now. The technology and the changes in the workforce compared to people coming out of high school 60 years ago, or even when I graduated high school 20 years ago, I think are really, really notable.
At this stage of the game, don't you think every student in the classroom is familiar with the computer and how it works?
I mean, they should be. They get them, you know, when they start school. My kids in school right now, and they get them. But at the same time, there are big differences. I mean, you could say that, was it slide rules in your day? Everyone should know a slide rule. And yeah, you know, I think I saw one in a museum one time.
I must say I didn't understand slide rules then, and I don't now. But you know what? I don't care. So there's some progress being made on that front. But Crystal Hill, the superintendent at CMS, spoke to the board about other challenges, including a shortage of counselors and other student support staff.
Our current ratio for our counselors is 1 to 300, which is not good. It's a lot. Our student support staff, our counselors, psychologists, all of those folks, the ratio is way out of whack.
Why is it out of whack? What is the impact of it being out of whack? How are they dealing with it being out of whack?
Well, I think the reasons are the same, that there are still teacher vacancies they're trying to close and bus driver vacancies they're trying to close. It comes down to pay and money. In terms of significance, I think, you know, when you think about a 1 to 300 counselor ratio, if your goal, which CMS has set, is getting your students enrolled in higher ed, enlisted in military or other public service, or employed straight out of high school, counselors and support staff are really crucial to that. Those are the people who make the connections between students and those things that come next. So a 1 to 300 ratio, I mean, it's hard to imagine helping 300 students who need very different levels of support effectively connect with one of those three options. So yes, teachers have been a big focus. Bus drivers have been a big focus. I think you're going to see more focus on counselors and support staff in the coming years, too.
At the federal level, we are now watching the emptying out of the government and the Department of Justice and other aspects of the federal law enforcement bureaucracy. And with all of that, I think yesterday, six or seven attorneys resigned in protest. And with all the churn going on in D.C., which is highly unusual. It would be easy to miss the departure of a that is completely normal. But this week, U.S. Attorney Dena King announced that she is stepping down from her position as the Western District's chief law enforcement officer. The district covers 32 counties in Western North Carolina. Again, Eli, this is not unusual, but why? Why is it happening?
So Dena King was appointed by President Biden, I believe, in 2021. Right. It is customary for appointed U.S. attorneys to resign when there's a change of administration. It's expected that the new administration will appoint their own district attorneys. It's still notable, I think, though, because Dena King was the first person of color to hold this position in the Western District. And she also made diversity a cornerstone, I think. She was quoted in a lot of places. She appeared in a lot of places to talk about the need for diversity and, you know, kind of a different face on law enforcement. And even though her resignation here is expected and normal, still notable, I think.
In the last election, Ben, North Carolina went marginally for Donald Trump at the national level and spectacularly for Josh Stein, our new governor. And a new Meredith College poll released this week reveals our state voters' opinions on a wide range of issues, as well as bipartisan support for Josh Stein. Tell us more.
What I would tell you is that this is probably part of the honeymoon phase. 58% of the people approve of the job he's doing, 19% disapprove. A lot of this more than likely really bolstered by his focus on Hurricane Helene and helping out the victims there, which has had bipartisan support. Keep in mind, the governor so far, not yet, still to come, will get into a fight with the General Assembly. Mark my words, it's going to happen just like it did with Roy Cooper. Sure. So he's not had to dirty his hands yet.
Recent precinct-by-precinct voting results released this week showed that North Carolina voters were clear in splitting the ticket, with 51% of them voting for Trump, but a far wider margin given to Stein in the governor's race, probably because of his opponent, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson. And the Meredith poll shows that 58% of respondents approve of the job Stein is doing, including 65% of Democrats, 54% of Republicans, 55% of unaffiliated voters, and more than two-thirds support Lumbee recognition. Is that a significant increase from the past?
It is, and it's something that the Lumbee folks have been fighting for years now, and they've recently gotten the support of some federal lawmakers. And I think you're seeing in those numbers the culmination of what has been a growing support for a group, a tribe based in the southeastern part of the state.
Respondents to this Meredith College poll also want casino gambling in the state, 58%, with slightly more Democrats favoring it than Republicans or unaffiliated voters, and 71% of North Carolinians support legalizing marijuana for medical use. There are members of the legislature who have been working, Eli, for years to make that happen, with voter approval apparently rising. Does that help those efforts?
I think it does. And on both of these issues, I think it's remarkable how out of step public policy is with the reality. I mean, casino gambling is not widely legal in North Carolina, except in a few places. You can pull up your phone and bet on anything. Marijuana is not legal here. There are billboards up and down every highway for cannabis delivery services. You can go and buy pot right now in Charlotte, and public policy is way behind.
We cannot leave without getting Mary Ramsey involved in this next topic, because Charlotte once had a women's basketball team, the Charlotte Sting, one of the original WNBA teams. When the league formed in 1997, they were here for 10 years until 2006, and they might be coming back as an expansion team. And the Hornets are on board. They're on board because they might need a player or two. Is that why, Mary? But aside from that, tell us more.
Yes, so this is something that the fans have wanted for a long time. I talked to some folks late last year on the tourism and city government side of things who said it's a great idea. We just don't know if anybody will step up and make a bid. Well, someone stepped up and made a bid. The Berman family, who are not from Charlotte but have some connections to Davidson, are leading a bid. They've gotten the endorsement of the Hornets ownership group and submitted a bid. That being said, it's certainly far from a sure thing. The bidding for the next team, it'll be the 16th team in the league, is going to be really competitive. It's going to be really expensive, and it's going to be a minute before we know. We're going up against about 8 to 9 other cities. So, but it's more progress than we've seen in a long time. So exciting times for Hoops fans.
And you weren't here, or were probably in diapers, when we were going after the Hornets franchise, and some national columnist said the only franchise Charlotte's going to get is McDonald's. Clearly that proved to be wrong. Are we likely to get this? Because we're a hot city for sports. Quickly.
It's a logical choice. There are not a lot of teams in the Southeast, and this is a hoops-loving state. So we're saying there's
Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, Ryan Pitkin, Queen City Nerve, Ben Thompson, WCNC-TV, and Eli Portillo from us. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.